If teachers are giving you rules for when you can and can't use AI tools, you have to take ownership of your own learning, your own training, right?
Hello and welcome to episode 452 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson. With me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. Today we have special guest Nick Hafen from BYU Law School. We'll get into Nick's background in a little bit. If you want to be LSAT famous, you can share news and ask questions on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. So Nick, let's talk to you. You reached out to us. You're the head of legal technology education at BYU Law. You Yep. lead the development of the law school's legal technology curriculum. You have apparently designed and taught a course on AI and law, mm-hmm. presented on AI at legal conferences, and drafted Gen AI, I'm assuming that's generative AI, yeah. use policies for law school courses. You got your JD at BYU, and you practiced bankruptcy and corporate law in private practice before going to the law school or joining the law school. Anything else we should add to that so our listeners know a little bit more about you?
No, that sounds good. I mean, we may get into more background later, but I think that's a good place to start.
Great. Well, yeah, so tell us what motivated you to reach out to us. What's the main message you want to send to our listeners, who are mainly people, you know, considering law school? Some people are in law school, but the vast majority are debating whether they want to go to law school. They're yeah. trying to get ready for the LSAT. They're applying to law school. Yeah.
I had put together some tips, like what law students should know about generative AI before they start their summer jobs. And I thought that that might be useful for pre-law students as well, right? People have talked a lot about how generative AI is disrupting the legal industry, maybe more than other technologies have in the past. And so people might be wondering, are there going to be legal jobs? What are those legal jobs going to look like? So I think it's definitely something pre-law students should be thinking about.
I'm sure they are. And if they weren't and they heard that, they said, okay, should yeah. I be worried about this? I mean, do you have a short answer to that? That tough question?
Yeah, I would say worried, no, but aware, yes. you should be learning about it so that you don't put yourself in a position to be replaced.
Mm. Great. Nathan, any questions that you want
to? I'm just scanning through. Nick wrote an article about, it says, what law students should know about generative AI before their summer jobs. There's four tips in here. The first one is know some basics about how the technology works, which, Nick, I think you can probably share some of that. But before yeah. you do, I wanted to talk about the second tip, which is because Gen AI is so new, students can add a lot of value if they understand how it should and shouldn't be used for legal work. I think that this really is an opportunity for our cohort, you know, Ben, our students in our LSAT classes. They really do need to know some rudimentary basics about this stuff. So, yeah, Nick, why don't you tell us a little bit what it's about and how law students should be thinking about it?
Sure. I think there's two parts to what you said, right? One part is like, what do I need to know to get by, right, to meet my ethical obligations as an attorney? And the second part is that real value add, right? This is something new. Attorneys often look to the younger attorneys to know about new technologies. And so if you can be relied upon to know these things, you don't need to be an expert. It doesn't take a whole lot of knowledge to know more than most attorneys on this subject. And so you can make yourself pretty valuable going forward. So the basics that I think people ought to know are first that things like ChatGPT, these generative AI tools, are not search engines. These companies have added in some functionality that includes search, but in general, they're just predicting likely strings of text based on all these, you know, written materials, all the text that they've consumed in the training phase. They got really good at guessing what word comes next. And so that's what they're doing. If you ask, what's the capital of Paris? It's not looking at a database. It's not looking at the training set. It's just predicting that Paris is the answer, right? Because those words are often seen in that arrangement in the training material.
Capital so it of France. You misspoke there, Nick. But
oh, did I?
I got what you. Yeah, I knew what you meant, though. Yes. You ask it for the capital of France, right, and it spits out Paris. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Not because it knows, just because it's read a lot of stuff that says that. And that's why we get hallucinations, right? And when we talk about legal use, some attorneys have gotten in trouble for relying on ChatGPT for legal research. You know, they'll say, give me five cases that say X or make this argument or refute that argument. And ChatGPT will give you five cases, right? It'll give you five very convincing looking citations to legal cases that don't exist. Sometimes it'll get a case right because the case comes up a lot in the training material. But often these cases just don't exist. And attorneys have filed motions and pleadings and briefs, including these cases that don't exist, gotten in trouble, gotten sanctioned. And it's because, you know, ChatGPT is just predicting a likely string of text. It's seen a lot of legal citations and it's going to make one up for you. And it's not going to tell you. There was one attorney in New York who he didn't do no due diligence, right? He asked for some cases, got some cases, and then said, are these real? And ChatGPT, of course, said, yes, these are real. You can find these in LexisNexis and Westlaw. And that was not true, right? So,
and all the dude had to do was take the time to look them up in Lexis exactly. or Westlaw. He was that lazy that he didn't even just check the citations.
Yep, yep. And so the legal AI tools that are starting to come out use something called retrieval augmented generation, which means before they give you a response, they do a search. So it's adding in that search engine. They'll look through relevant documents like cases, find the most relevant ones, and then, you know, put in a query to the large language model saying, answer this question based on these documents. And that's how like LexisNexis is giving you links to cases. You have to be careful because it can still hallucinate. It's still running on, you know, a regular large language model underneath, but it will give you links to real cases. So I think those are kind of the basics about how it works that pre-law, law students, new lawyers need to know.
And that's the kind of tool that is going to get people replaced, right? I mean, that's where a young lawyer who knows how to use this technology, who knows what it can and can't do, can come in and start doing the work of two lawyers or four lawyers.
Right, right. And I don't know if it'll be people getting replaced in the sense of being laid off or fired, but hiring may go down, right? And you want to be one of the ones who gets picked, right? You want to be the associate who can get a ton of research done really well in a short amount of time, but the really well is important, right? You have to go back and you have to check. Make sure the cases are real, make sure they say what the model says they say, and make sure they're still good law, right? This does not replace traditional legal research, but it can speed it up an awful lot, and it can point you to cases that you wouldn't have otherwise found.
Yeah.
And all that's going to just get better, right? It's just going to get better and better. And I mean, we're talking to people who are planning to go to law school maybe this fall, maybe next fall. So mm-hmm. they're graduating 3, 4, 5 years from now. By then, this yeah. technology's got to be extremely better.
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
the worst it's going to be right now.
Right. What is the BYU? Does yeah. BYU Law have an official policy on using generative AI in classes?
The approach that we took was to let each professor decide for their class, just because there's different types of law classes, right? Like in the doctrinal classes, the substantive stuff, You probably don't want people using it, definitely not on exams. But there are practical skills-based courses, and there are clinics, right? And in that case, it doesn't matter so much, you know, that you didn't come up with an idea on your own, as long as you make sure it's still good law, right? So, and paper classes, professors have different preferences for whether and how students use it.
Nick, when I think about whether or not people can use it, I guess it seems like we've evolved our testing over time, right, to make it difficult for people to cheat right? People can cheat on exams. Yeah. But you have to go to this room. You have to download this computer on your laptop that severely limits a bunch of other functionality, right? It almost seems like, to the extent you can't enforce it, you have to adapt to it, right? Like, you can tell people, hey, you can't use ChatGPT, but unless there's some way to enforce that, it seems like law schools and just schools in general have to change.
I agree. I think people have to find new ways of building skills and assessing skills, right? Mm-hmm. You know, with calculators, before calculators, people maybe did 3 math problems for homework. And after calculators, you do 10, right? So that's one way, right? You just do more. But you will have to find just new ways, right? Like, if writing is really important to the professor, like the quality of writing, you may have to do like pen on paper, you know, like sitting in class, typing, right, where the professor can see what you're doing. But if you're teaching a law class, that, you know, on AI or criminal law or anything really, and you don't care so much about the quality of the writing as the substance, as what they're saying, their legal analysis, well, maybe you decide, like, I don't care as much if you use AI. What I really care about is if you're getting to a good argument, a good analysis, good evaluation of the material that we've been talking about. So teachers, instructors are going to have to change and adapt. For sure.
Yeah. I mean, I'll let this go, but I've been struggling with it in part because I have kids who are in school, right? And it's on the one hand, they're not allowed to use this for school, but on the other hand, I feel like it's an opportunity to use a tool and figure out how to use it. Cause I can't imagine like doing work without it today, right? I use it all the time. I was just writing stuff yesterday and I'm writing things and I'm saying, hey, what's another way of phrasing this? And it's not that I'm going to use what ChatGPT gives me. It's more that the ideas it generates make me a better writer, right? But it would be weird not to develop the skills of interaction. It just seems like something that I would hope or imagine at some point is going to have to be brought into the schools and just become another tool that everyone is interacting with and getting better at using, rather than like, oh, no, you can't use that. That's not allowed, because otherwise you're at a disadvantage.
Definitely. And what you said is, you guys talk a lot about having an ownership mindset, right? When you're telling students about admissions and things, like, it's not like admissions people are generally lying to you, but you need to understand their interests, where they're coming from, and where your interests do or do not align, so that you can properly evaluate that, right? Like, if they're telling you, you know, you have to let us know by this date, we'll ask for an extension, right? So if teachers are giving you rules for when you can and can't use AI tools, you have to take ownership of your own learning, your own training, right? And that's just as true in law school and the legal industry. You know, there are some rules you have to follow, right? If a court says you have to disclose if you use this, you got to follow that. But that doesn't stop you from finding other ways to try things out. And that's really the way to do it, right? I mean, you can read all you want, but you've used it a lot. Like, the best way to learn it is to just use it. And you don't have to learn it all at once. There's so much out there that you could learn that's intimidating. Just start like a little bit at a time. Try for one thing. Try for something else. Like, just a little bit at a time. And you'll start to build up that skill. Don't use it in ways that your firm tells you not to. Don't put in client information. Like, there's some hard boundaries. But you really should take the initiative and of your own training, right? Because there's a chance this kind of stuff undermines law school training or lawyer training, because it automates things that have been used for training in the past. But you have to make sure that doesn't happen, right? Like, your kids can use this to study better, right? Not to replace learning, but to enhance it. And so I think that's a really important use case.
Well, I mean, I think, I guess I'm curious, Nick, where do you see this going, even just in the next couple of years? We were talking to Ross Guberman a few episodes ago. He's a legal writing expert, and he goes to all sorts of law firms around the world and trains attorneys from summer associates up to partners on how to write. And he was saying that the people he was talking to were looking at how generative AI was being used to not just generate briefs, but to really take them and evaluate them for their logical coherence. Was the most effective argument used here? Why or why not? Even if that feedback is not 100% accurate, right? It's essentially free.
Yeah,
it's extraordinarily fast, and it's just going to keep getting better. And I was surprised to hear that, you know, companies are already doing that, but also I'm not surprised. I mean, who doesn't want to jump on this and try to figure out how to take an employee who costs $200,000, $300,000 a year, maybe more, and replace them with something that's almost free and way faster, works 24/7, doesn't complain. Anything you teach it also percolates to all other activities in the firm. You don't have to retrain each separate AI if you think of humans as AI. Yeah.
And that's why you want to be the associate who knows how to do all that, right? Who knows how to use the AI to practice, to do it better and faster and cheaper, because they'll want to hire you, you know, to save them money, even if you cost a lot of money still. I think firms are going to have to figure out what they do with training. That's going to come up pretty quickly, right? You can make a quick buck now by replacing a lot of your associates with AI, but at some point that hollows out your pipeline and you don't have the people you need to do the higher level stuff. They haven't had the training they need. So figuring that out is going to be important. And that's why I really want people to use AI to enhance their training rather than undermine it, hollow it out. But yeah, I think it's going to get used more and more. There are getting to be more and more specific use cases, like vendors that are specifically using generative AI to evaluate deal terms in deal documents, or using generative AI to redline SaaS contracts in-house. It's going to get used more and more, and I think it's going to almost become more invisible, right, in that sense. When we think of AI, we don't think of Google search, but that's what it is. It's just going to be kind of in the background of a lot of things. But to understand what's happening, that's pretty important in a lot of legal work. Like legal research, you have to know what you're not looking at, right? Is the AI looking at only these kinds of cases? If that's the case, I need to supplement with some other research. So understanding how it works is pretty important. And even as it becomes more and more invisible, I think that remains true.
So what do you do then if you're an LSAT student 1 or 2 or 3 years before law school, or if you're a 1L just starting law school? If you're totally clueless, what do you do to learn about this technology?
Yeah, I would, if you really have no idea, you know, how to even start using it, just start Googling, right? Like, how can law students use ChatGPT? How can pre-law students use it, right? Just start with something, right?
ChatGPT specifically?
I don't think it matters that much. You can learn a lot from these free ones. So using the free version of ChatGPT or Anthropic's Claude model, or I'm trying to remember some of the others. But the free one, there's a lot of ones that have a free tier that you can use. So go ahead and use that. If you're a law student, it depends on the law school. You may have access to Lexis's AI, Lexis Plus AI is what it's called. And you may have access to Westlaw's Practical Law AI. And I would really encourage you to use those, right? Because those are specifically made for legal. Law firms are going to be using those. So just like things that you're already doing, try it out, right? So I still practice on the side doing small business transactional stuff. So, I have to create a privacy policy for one of my clients. Well, why don't I go into ChatGPT and see what it gives me, right? I still have to look, you know, make sure that's correct, compare it to other resources that I have to make sure it's got all the things that it needs. But that's something I was already doing, right? Start trying it with things that you're already doing to see how it works. Tweak your prompts a little bit the next time you do it. Try a different tool the next time you do it, just to start to broaden your experience. And I think naturally you start to see more ways that you can use it. You can talk to other people about how they're using it. If you look on LinkedIn, people will post about how they're using it. Twitter X probably has that too. I don't really look at that very often, but I'm sure people are talking about it on there. So start small and, you know, just add a little bit.
I couldn't agree more. I was thinking about specifically the example you just gave, right? You needed a privacy agreement for one of your clients, and you you could ask it to create it. That's one thing. But even if you have one that you've created, or you have a boilerplate document that you've used for years, I think the more you use it, the more you just have these random thoughts of like, oh, I could use it for this, right? Like if I came into your firm and you were like, hey, give this privacy agreement to one of our clients, they need to sign it for this thing. Even if you're like, it's 100% good to go, we've been using it for 10 years, don't worry about it. It's so easy to copy and paste, put that in and say, hey, are there any terms we just haven't thought about, or, you know, are written in a way that may hurt us? And, you know, it could be wrong about the feedback it provides, but at the very least, it might point out two things that you're like, oh, we never thought about that. Just add it. And it takes literally a minute, right? It takes longer for you to put the text in there and write the prompt or adjust the prompt than it is for it to respond to you. And by the way, prompts, for anyone who's not familiar, is just your command to the AI. I think if anyone's listening right now and they're not using it, I just think you're missing out on opportunities no matter what kind of job you do, unless, of course, your job is just totally hands-on. But even just in your day-to-day life, I use it constantly. Maybe I'm an overuser, but it's so easy, right? It's so easy to just boss it around. And it, so many times too, it will like give you feedback and it'll say, oh, this is how you can learn more. And I'm like, no, please go ahead and look that up for me. But anyways,
it's even when it's wrong, it's often usefully wrong, right?
Yeah. Like,
I do a lot of writing. And so sometimes, you know, I get excited. I think maybe ChatGPT can do this whole article for me or even a section of it, right? And so you craft a prompt, you get some instructions, put in an outline, and what it gives you is not useful, right? But you prepared all that material to put it in, and often what I've found is in looking at what it gives me, I see, well, that's actually not the direction I wanted to go, and it helps me progress, right? Even if I don't use anything it wrote, it has often gotten me started or helped me refine the direction that I want to go. And done it faster than if I had, you know, looked at a blank cursor or, you know, done the other things that I usually do to get started.
It is super useful for avoiding that super scary blank page. I'm looking at your last tip here that says use technology to help people. And one thing that strikes me is many, many of our students want to go to law school, not for the money, but because they want to help various people. And I would encourage them to just, you know, if you want to ask it a question just to get started, ask it how you can help the people that you want to help. Just start talking to it. Just ask it and see what it says. And it will be wrong, but it'll be usefully wrong, like you say, Nick, that you'll ask it and it'll give you 10 or 20 ideas. And 19 of them will be terrible. And you'll be like, no, not doing that, not doing that, not doing that. But the one that it's like, so on the one hand, you're ruling out the things you don't want to do, which is useful. Then you're also getting the one out of 20 or whatever where you go, oh, wow, tell me more about that.
Yeah. I want to say that too, because it always seems to give me way more ideas than I can just like implement in any one time. But I always tell it, I just go back and say, okay, well, tell me more about steps 2 and 5. Right.
Yeah. Or how could I combine steps 2 and 5 together?
Yep.
Yep. Or give me this slight modification of number 3. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have found it really helpful for like learning new things in that regard. And that I feel like if you go into a professor's office hours, you're a little bit worried about taking up their time. You're a little bit worried about asking a dumb question. And with ChatGPT or, you know, other Anthropic, whatever you want to use, you can be really detailed. You can say, no, go back and explain that in more detail. No, I still don't get it. Give me another example. And, you know, of course, especially if you're getting into really specific stuff, you got to make sure it's correct. You got to do some other search. And that's not too hard to do usually. But it can really help you dig into something in a way that you might not want to with your classmates or with a professor.
Nick, unless you want to say anything else about generative AI right now, it would be nice to shift into your background a little bit. You practiced big law for
about a few years? Almost 3 years, yeah.
3 years. And then you
moved, right after that, I started a solo practice. I joined an incubator program in Chicago where they help you start your own practice. And I did that because I knew I was interested in legal tech, and when you're in big law, it's pretty hard to do anything on the side. And so I decided to start my own practice so I could do more of that.
They have an incubator for people to start their own law firm?
Yeah, it's with the Chicago Bar Foundation. It's called the Justice Entrepreneurs Project. And so they provide some training and some resources, like you get free access to Lexis for, you know, 6 months or a year or something. And got other people around you, they assign you a mentor, people who have done the same thing. They assign you to a legal aid organization for the first bit so that you can get some hours in. I mean, it's, you know, it's always good to do pro bono work, but it's also a kind of a training thing because a lot of people are doing a new area of law. So you have a lot of support, and it makes it a lot easier to start something than it would be just on your own.
And do you feel like you needed those 3 years of big law experience to really start the solo journey?
You know, I think having any experience before you go solo is helpful. It's not always directly applicable, right? Like I did big Chapter 11 bankruptcies. I don't do that now. I do small business transactional stuff. But like you guys have talked before about attention to detail. When you were talking about that Paul Hastings slide, having some fun with that, you know, like the expectations of a new associate. But one thing, you know, you didn't criticize from there was they emphasized attention to detail, right? Like that is really important. And they really hammer that in big law. And so that's definitely something that carries over. There's a lot that carries over, even if the subject matter or area of law is not the same. So I don't think it had to be big law, though.
It had, but just some experience.
Yeah.
And how long was that incubator?
So it's an 18-month program, and then you graduate and you kind of remain in their network. I was in there for about 6 months when I applied for my current job, which is like my dream job. So I did not complete the program, but I'm a big fan of it.
Okay, so you were planning to go solo. You then said, hey, wait a sec, there's this opportunity to work as a professor. And so
Yeah. So I'm technically in the law library. It turns out a lot of legal tech positions are in the law library because they're the ones who have, you know, traditionally been handling like vendors and access to legal information, LexisNexis, things like that. So but I teach classes. I do like one-off lunch and learn type trainings. It's a lot of fun. I get to learn a ton of new stuff all the time, and I enjoy it a lot.
I guess I was a little surprised to hear that you still have this practice on the side. Is that because your job doesn't just demand you full time and you can pursue these things on the side? Is that unusual or is that common?
I think a fair amount of law professors will do some work, like some consulting or expert witness work, occasionally legal work. For me, I wanted to remain involved in the practice of law because that's so relevant to what I'm teaching. I didn't want to get behind and get dated. And it gives me a lot of use cases, right? So I can tell law students, well, I was just doing a privacy policy, you know, and I used ChatGPT in this way, or I used Practical Law AI in this way. So it gives me a lot of material to work with. There are definitely times where I think, why did I do this? Why did I decide to, you know, keep this job? But I also do it on a subscription basis. And so there's high months and low months. So it's not always too taxing.
Oh, so your clients pay you a subscription. You have a subscription model.
Yep.
Interesting. And then if they come to you for work, then you got work. And if they don't, then you don't. And so then, yeah, okay. Your income stays stable.
You have to
stable.
Make sure you do it ethically. There's, you know, you have to follow the rules, and it can depend on the state how you do it, whether it has to go into your trust fund. But you can do it, and it works out pretty well for clients because a lot of legal problems can be avoided if you catch it early, and
mm.
They don't want to get billed, you know, thousands of dollars every time they pick up the phone, and so they'll put things off. So I think it works well for the lawyer and the client.
Is that becoming more common in legal practice? Because I don't think I've ever heard of a law firm trying to, well, I guess I've heard of like online sites that have a subscription model, but
I think it is becoming more common. There's a, you know, a community out there of people who are doing it, and I think it's, I expect alternative fee arrangements to become more common, especially with generative AI, just because you can do things so much faster. If you bill hourly, that's not super helpful. but if you, I talked to a partner at a law firm who gave me this example. They put together, when their clients, like a private equity firm, forms a partnership, an investment vehicle, they do a long memo evaluating the partnership agreement. And they looked at their past billing, and it figured out it usually takes about 15 hours to put this together of attorney time. And then they trained an AI bot to do it. It does it in minutes instead. And they can charge a flat fee that's, you know, about like 10 hours worth of attorney time. It saves the client money. And they can actually scale that up a lot. They can do a lot more of those and make more money than they were doing an hourly model. So I think people are going to experiment more with non-hourly billing.
Yeah, well, it comes more to the value, right? What's the value of what we're offering you? We're going to charge you that rather than some a little bit disconnected pricing scheme, which is like, okay, this is how long it took me to give this work to you, but how much is it actually worth to you? That can be very different.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of stuff for people to see changing over the years, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's fun. It's sometimes hard to keep track of everything, but it's fun to see things changing.
Yeah, especially in an industry that tends to change very slowly, right? Like the law is probably one of the more molasses moving
yes.
groups.
Yeah, people are still using WordPerfect. On occasion, so
I even forgot that it existed, but okay.
Yeah, that's funny. Can we transition from law firm financing to law school financing, Nick?
For sure.
I'm gonna share my screen here so everybody can see. This is our tuition roll call tool. I don't know, Nick, if you sound like you've listened to a few episodes of the podcast, so I'm not sure if you've heard us talking about law school financing very much.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So this is LSATdemon.com, and we've built a tool that just visualizes the public data, the American Bar Association section, standard 509 information report, and the data that we're drawing from is down here, this grants and scholarships table, which is kind of ugly to look at. And we made instead this tool here so that you can just kind of visualize what that looks like. First of all, does this look correct to you? Or does this seem about right for BYU that there are a significant number of students on campus who are getting stipends?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not in admissions, and so
right.
you know, I don't know all the details, but I know we have a scholarship called the Clark Scholarship that has a stipend, and I think that's, I want to say 10 or 15 students a year.
Okay.
And it sounds like there's probably some additional ones beyond that. I know at one point in the past few years, the law school was publicizing that they had given every student a scholarship that year. So it looks like that's not specifically true of this year.
Well, almost though, because so this is looking back at last year's 509 report, but there were only 11% of the students on the 509 are listed as paying full price. That's actually 42 students out of all 3 years that are there right now. There's 42 students at BYU who are paying all of the full tuition. There are
quite a bit less than other schools.
Well, it's more than some schools. I mean, we see some schools. We were just talking about one last episode where apparently there's like 1% of the class that's paying full price.
Was that Campbell?
Campbell, right. Campbell getting 99%. Whatever. We're digging into whether that maybe could have been an error on the 509 report, because it seems too crazy to be true. But we have heard of law schools giving full rides, like when Irvine started. When UC Irvine started, they gave a full ride to everybody in their new class to, like, kickstart the law school.
Right.
BYU is not a new law school, but they are giving lots of scholarships to attract top talent. There are, in addition to the 11% who are paying full price, there are 27% who are paying something more than half tuition. If you add those two numbers together, you get 38% of the student body paying half or more of the tuition.
Mm-hmm.
Then the scholarships start kicking in. There's 12% who have gotten somewhere between a half scholarship and a 50% scholarship. There are another 19% who apparently are there on a full ride, so paying zero tuition. And then 31% getting a stipend. That does result in 50% of the students BYU right now getting a full ride or full ride plus. Now, you said that it was like a couple of years ago, you think, that BYU gave the entire starting class a scholarship, or the entire 1L class a scholarship?
Yeah, there was actually a donor who came and basically said, what would it take to give everybody a scholarship? So I'm not sure if it was like a 1 year thing or a few years, but yeah, that was at least 1 year that they did.
And
that.
You don't know if that was a full scholarship or just a partial scholarship.
I assume it was not full for everybody.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting.
So Nick, one thing I'm a little confused about with BYU's scholarship information is that because BYU is a church school and it gives discounts to students who are members of the church, right?
Yeah.
Is that considered a scholarship, or is that just a discount? Because I see that they have resident and non-resident numbers. If you scroll up on the 509, see it has a resident tuition of $15,000 and a non-resident of $30,000. I wonder if almost everyone is getting that resident tuition and that's considered a scholarship, or if it's just considered that's the tuition and then they're doing scholarships on top of that.
I think that's considered the tuition. I don't think they consider the reduced tuition a scholarship.
Okay.
I could be wrong, but that would be my guess.
Yeah, common sense, I would think I wouldn't find that interpretation, yeah. Ben. I would think that what Nick is saying is, yeah, this is probably the tuition that they're nominally charging people, but then the real story comes down here where you see the grant amounts.
Yeah, well, I mean, it has a 75th percentile grant amount of $19,000, which would be higher than that 15. But yeah, I guess those are the stipends, maybe.
That's where those stipends are coming from, potentially, is locals who are getting a full ride plus a few thousand dollars.
Okay.
That would make sense.
So BYU is relatively reasonably priced. If you consider that the non-resident is $30,000, resident is $15,000, but that's going to be the price for the vast majority of students. Yep. So, wow. I mean, just so many law schools are north of $60,000 per year. Even if you don't get a
scholarship. Yeah, BYU is a bargain for Utah natives, for sure. Do you know what the policy is, Nick, for getting BYU resident or getting Utah residency?
So it's not Utah residency that matters. It's just membership in the church. Members
and that gets you resident tuition.
Yeah, I think they've listed it here as resident, non-resident, because you know, that's the analogy. But yeah, it's membership in the church. Members of the church pay a 10% tithing, and so that's usually the rationale given for that discount. Like people pay in-state taxes.
Interesting. Had you looked at the tuition roll call before? I'm just curious.
You have a scholarship something. Scholarship.
Yeah, scholarship estimator is right here.
Yeah, I looked at that. It was interesting to see that my scores would not have gotten me as much now as I got back then. And that wasn't that long ago.
It's gotten more competitive. Since COVID, we've seen scores 175 and higher go up by over 100%. And we've seen scores 170 and higher go up by over 50%.
Wow.
Yeah. So it is more competitive than whenever you went to law school.
Yep. Yeah. And I graduated in 2019, so not too long ago.
Great, Nick. Well, thanks so much for coming on. Is there any question that we didn't ask you that we should have?
No, I don't think so. I will say I have kind of an interesting LSAT story that
Cool.
I don't know how instructive it would be. So I was a TA on a study abroad program the semester when I was taking the LSAT. So I was in Jordan. And if I listened to your podcast, I would not have made some of the mistakes that I did. I took the December LSAT and applied in January. So I've now learned that I should have waited a year or, you know, hurried up a little bit. But I took it in Jordan. So I showed up on a Saturday at this random building, you know, just following the address. And there was a security guard there. He was Jordanian. He was like, "What are you doing here? It's the weekend." I was like, "I'm supposed to take a test here." And he said, there's no tests. It's the weekend." And so I was freaking out. An American woman walked in behind me, and so I stopped her and asked if she knew anything about it. And she said, "Well, come in and let me look into it." So I sat down in the lobby for like 20 minutes and just getting more and more nervous, right? I showed up early, you know, to avoid these kinds of things. Another woman came down and said, "Are you here? What test are you here for?" And then she went back up. Finally, they brought me up, gave me a test that said LSAT. I was the only person there, so it was me and the proctor sitting in the room. And you know, I took the test, and later that night I was online trying to figure out, just like everybody else, like which section is the experimental one. And I did not recognize any of the passages that people were referring to. And I got really worried that they had just given me, like they just found something sitting around that said LSAT, like a past one or something. but I found out from searching online that they give a different form of the test overseas. And so I felt a lot better after that. But it was a very stressful experience. I don't recommend it.
You just took it once and that was it, right?
I took it once, yeah.
No. In Jordan.
Yep.
Yeah. One thing you might have heard us complain about on the podcast in the past is that they only offer the test 4 times per year to international students instead of 9 times a year to domestic and Canada, I guess. Pre-COVID, one of the obvious problems, before they started administering the test online, one of the obvious problems was proctoring. And so I can see how, you know, when you're the only person sitting in the room in Jordan with a proctor, that's not cost effective for them to be administering tests that way. So I can see how they would not want, you know, not be excited about offering that 9 times a year. Now that it's gone online, though, we're curious, I guess, why they haven't opened that up to.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Old habits, maybe.
Old habits are a law industry specialty.
That's a good place to leave it, probably. How do people learn more about you, Nick?
I'm on LinkedIn. You can just look up my name. I've got a bio on the law school website. I think that's probably the best way for people to find me.
Excellent. Right. And is this list of tips published anywhere?
It's forthcoming. So as soon as it's out, I'll send you the link.
Okay, cool. Great.
Perfect. Again, that was Nick Hafen. Thanks again, Nick, for coming on, and this will air next week.
Thank you for having me on, guys. That was enjoyable, and I enjoyed listening to your podcast, getting ready for this. I'm glad there's people doing what you're doing.
It's awesome that you actually listened to a bit of the show. I was pleasantly surprised, and so we definitely appreciate you taking the time to do that, Nick.
I learned new things, so
it was good. Great.
All right, thanks. We'll be in touch.
Take care. Thanks.
Let's jump into word of the week. This is from your niece.
Yeah. So I'm home visiting my folks in the Central Valley of California, and my niece is bragging about how she and her friends constantly use the word defenestration. She said it's my favorite word.
Her and her friends constantly use it?
My favorite word is, she says, my favorite word is defenestration. She's a high school junior, and she talks about defenestration all the time.
I'm just surprised because it's a long word with multiple syllables, right? Like, it That's seems like popular they're... words.
Nah, it's not like it's short. In the popular. She's a nerd. She's like one of the smart kids.
She's an, know? She's related to you. Okay, got it.
She's doing well, and she likes to think of herself as smart. And this is the type of thing that a smart ass, I would have done this when I was in high school because I was a dork and a nerd and thought I was smart. Yeah. So, yeah, anyway, defenestration, Ben. Any guess? I could give you, let me give it to you in context.
Sure. Do you want me to, okay, I can try without context. And then we'll see if the context helps a little bit. So,
okay.
I see, like, it doesn't say defense, but there is this defend element or defense element at the beginning. So maybe it has to do with blocking or rebutting something. I have no idea. What's the context?
Yeah, something like, that was such a terrible idea that we considered it and then just defenestrated it immediately.
So to dismiss it or to reject it.
Yeah.
Okay.
This would be something that would be very dangerous to do to a person, extremely dangerous to do this to a person, especially if you were on a very high floor of a building. Okay, defenestration on the first floor is bad. Defenestration on the 100th floor is
fatal. So this is to push away?
Yeah, it is specifically the act of throwing someone out of the window.
Oh, and so they're using it metaphorically as they threw out the idea.
No, or they probably say, like, I'm going to defenestrate you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm concerned about your niece.
I think she's doing just fine. I think that's exactly what high school kids are supposed to be doing.
Yeah, but... Okay. So, nerd... Yeah, anyways, interesting. Cool.
You want to do Pearls versus Turds?
Let's do it. Yeah, why not?
Yeah.
So this is from Henry. Uh-huh. Henry notes that he reached the mid-170s with 1 to 2 hours a day studying with Demon Basic and the podcasts.
Sweet.
What does he have to say?
When test anxiety hits at the beginning of a section, think about your historical performance on the first 10 questions. I've found that this calms me down and eliminates the need to double-check my answers since I always get the first 10 right. Thanks, Henry.
Interesting. Okay, so a section is starting. Henry's going into maybe section one or question one or question two.
And test anxiety is hitting him.
Yep, he's feeling anxious, and he says, hey, look, I know I've done very well on these first 10 questions in the past. This is definitely not a turd. Whether it's a pearl and something that people need to do, everyone needs to think about, I don't know. But I'm glad that Henry is mindful. That's a definite pearl, right? Being aware of your thoughts and your feelings and what works for you in terms of making you perform better.
Yeah. I wouldn't want this to be an excuse for being sloppy, but it is a pretty big problem, I think, Ben. One of the reasons why people will sometimes underperform on their official test, that they don't underperform on their practice tests, is because they feel anxiety during the official test that they don't feel during their practice tests, and then that anxiety causes them to do dumb things. One of the things that you can do that's really dumb is that if you're feeling the anxiety, you start double checking not just the correct answers, but you're like double checking the wrong answers to make sure that maybe though they could have been right. And that is the wrong kind of double checking to do on this test. If you're going to make it through, you know, for Henry scoring in the mid 170s, you're going to do the vast majority of the questions on the test. I'm not saying you're going to finish the sections, but you're not going to guess on very many. You're going to guess on a couple at the end of the section and still score 170. You should always go calmly, carefully. You should always focus on finding the right answer, but you don't have time to. You read an answer, it looks like garbage. You now do not have time to try to ungarbage it in your mind because there's 4 wrong answers on every single question. And you need to just be like swiping left on wrong answers. And the right answer should be apparent to you if you're doing it right, if you've attacked the argument properly, if you've thought about the question, if you've tried to make some prediction. Then when you go into the answers, it's going to be like, nope, nope, exactly, nope, nope. Next question. And if you're not doing it that way, you're just real unlikely to score in the mid 170s in 35 minutes, right? So to the extent that Henry is, you know, he has the track record to justify this strategy.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Like he really just doesn't miss questions in the first 10. That's not going to happen very often if you're scoring in the 170s. You're not going to miss the easy ones. You can't miss the easy ones and score in the 170s, is what I'm saying. So he scores in the 170s. He knows the right answers are right. He knows the wrong answers are wrong. On these easier questions, especially at the beginning of the section, if he feels like the answer is C for question number one, it's C. And this tip of going like, dude, you never miss questions in the first 10. You know that's the answer. Let's keep it moving. I think that that could be a pearl for someone who's in this, in these circumstances.
Yeah, well, I think being the act of being mindful and being conscious of this, what's happening at the beginning of a section, how he feels, what thought processes are work for him, total pearl. I also love the fact that we're talking about Henry, who's scoring in the mid-170s, and he's someone who has test anxiety. There are a lot of people out there who have test anxiety, and they think, oh, well, if I was scoring in the 170s, you know, I wouldn't have that problem. Like, no, you can have that problem and still score very high.
And that happens. Some of our teachers are like that. You know, we've got teachers who it took them five times to score in the 170s. Mm-hmm. And they're not afraid to talk about their bad performances and their anxiety that they've had. It doesn't happen to everybody. You know, the best thing that I could try to instill in people who have scored in the mid-170s is a bit of swagger. Some people just have that naturally. I've always had it. When it comes to tests, I got it. I'm not afraid of tests, ever. I have just haven't ever been. And that's great when I'm prepared. But it's not... Everybody doesn't fall into that camp. And so I do think that this is a pearl for someone who is in those circumstances. Like, you have justified, you should feel confident when you're answering these questions in the first 10, because your practice tests indicate that you just never miss those questions. So you should have a bit of swagger. You should expect that one or two of them might bump you a little bit, and it might take you a little extra time to sort those ones out. But yeah, on 8 or 9 out of the first 10, you got to just be like, take your time with the passage, take your time with the question. But then you cannot grind your way through every single answer on the, you know, every single one of those wrong answers. You just can't be looking to like prove negatives when you've already positively identified the answer.
Excellent. Let's give it a pearl.
I think so.
Yeah.
Scoreboard now shows in the long history of pearls versus turds, we have 29 pearls, 79 turds, and 26 ties.
Awesome.
If you have a pearls versus turd candidate, you should let us know at thinkinglsat.com or find us on social at LSATDemon. Yeah, you want to do this one from Justin maybe and then wrap it up?
Sure. Dear Ben and Nathan, I was wondering how you would approach a difficult question with a bunch of conditional statements without diagramming the stimulus. Interesting. Would you be willing to walk through your thought process on a question like this, for example? Okay, and then Justin provides a example problem. Thank you. I'm enjoying the podcast a ton and love the advice you guys give. Okay, so unfortunately, the question that you're linking to is a question that we can't talk about on the podcast because of our agreement with LSAC to keep these questions private. But producer Eric kindly made up a version of this, of something similar, I guess. Eric writes, if I wear a hat today, I'll leave for work at 7 a.m. If I wear a coat today, I'll leave for work at 8 a.m. Okay. Nathan, do you feel the need to draw this out to understand those two ideas?
No, I don't. And I think it would only hurt. I cannot imagine. The days of me using a whiteboard in every LSAT lesson are long gone. I use a whiteboard when I teach the games, and I do not use a whiteboard at any other point in my LSAT instruction. I just don't think it's helpful.
That's so funny you say that. Sorry to cut you off, but I have this whiteboard behind me, right? It's been here because it's been a staple, and I never use it. And this just frees me up, actually, a little bit to move around my setup. But anyways.
Right. Yeah, time to take that down, at least once the June LSAT is over, and you're not going to be doing any logic games instruction anymore. It just doesn't help. For LR.
Yeah.
I could diagram it, but I can also do it in my head faster and easier and more reliably. And I don't even need to picture these facts in order to understand the point of the question. Mm-hmm. If the facts are, if I wear a hat today, I'll leave for work at 7 a.m. If I wear a coat today, I'll leave for work at 8 a.m. And then if the question said, which one of the following, you know, if the statements above are true, which one of the following must be true? What's the point of putting these two facts next to each other? First of all, they're very arbitrary rules. I don't see why a hat makes me leave at 7 a.m. I don't see why a coat makes me leave at 8 a.m. But what I do notice is that one of them makes me leave at 7. That's early. One of them makes me leave at 8. That's a little bit later.
Yep. So you can't do both, right?
I can't do both. So I'm hoping for the coat because I don't like to get up early. So I'm hoping for the coat. I'm not hoping for the hat. If I wear the hat, apparently I got to leave for work at 7. So then I can't leave at 8. Oh, and then that means I also can't wear a coat.
That's right. And vice versa, right? If you're wearing a coat, then you're going to leave at 8, and there's no way you can put a hat on that day. What does this tell you about if you don't wear either one?
If I don't wear either one, then that's, yeah, and that's actually what I would be thinking as I'm, like, laying in bed the night before going, like, I don't want to get up early. It's cold. Okay, well, if I don't wear a hat, I don't have to leave at 7, and if I don't wear a coat, I don't have to leave at 8. Okay, cool. I'll leave at noon, and I'll wear shorts and a flip-flop and flip-flops. That'd be great. If I don't leave it, if I don't wear a hat, I can do whatever I want. If I don't wear a coat, I can do whatever I want. So if I don't wear a hat and I don't wear a coat, then I really am freed up. I can leave at whatever time I want to leave.
I think this conversation proves what we're trying to say, right? And that is that you don't need to draw things to figure out what's going on. And if you're following along with what we're saying, then you've made sense of these two sentences without any sort of diagramming. In fact, you're not even looking at the sentences, which is even harder.
Yeah. The people who can diagram reading. It, yeah. You know, bravo, but I think you can also just do it in your head and talk about it commonsensically just as quickly. Yeah. And for the people who can't diagram it, then diagramming is a bad idea anyway. I think the diagramming is much harder than the just understanding it in common sense terms. You know, what's the trigger on the rule? The trigger on the rule is wearing a hat. That's the trigger on the first rule. The trigger on the second rule is if I wear a coat. So if I wear a hat, I have to leave at 7. If I wear a coat, I have to leave at 8. As long as I don't wear a hat and don't wear a coat, there's no rules. But the second I wear a hat or a coat, then it's going to kick off this whole chain and I can just, yeah, if I wear a hat, I have to leave at 7. If I leave at 7, I did not leave at 8. And if I don't leave at 8, then I can't wear a coat. So if I wear a hat, I can't wear a coat. And then the same thing is going to work in reverse. If I wear a coat, I have to leave at 8. If I leave at 8, I didn't leave at 7. If I didn't leave at 7, I can't wear a hat. So if I wear a coat, I can't wear a hat. And that would be the correct answer, right? They would end up asking you, which one of the following must be true? And the answer would be like, if Justin wears a coat, he does not wear a hat.
Yeah. You know, I want to talk about one thing you said. You said, and it may depend on what you meant by this, but you said there are people who can diagram and fine, whatever, and then there are people who can't, and you think if they can't, they definitely shouldn't. Well, I agree with you there. But I also think that the people who can diagram these things often get into trouble when they don't realize
it. Oh, yeah.
So, for example, yeah.
No, you go ahead. But yeah. Okay, so, go ahead.
Yeah,
let's hear.
So
we can both
you
tell
do it,
horror
right?
stories.
Yeah. So what happens? This is a simple example. So it says, if I wear a hat today, I'll leave for work at 7. So what I would have done a long, long time ago, I would have written down like H, if H, then
arrow.
7. Yeah, arrow, 7 then 7, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So in this particular example, these sentences are so simple that going from the sentence to a diagram that says H arrow 7 is probably fine, but there are longer if-then statements on the LSAT. And when people convert them, they lose information because they take 10 words and they put it into one letter, and the correct answer may not hinge on the if-then nature of that sentence, but rather something within those 10 words that have now been boiled down into the letter H, and you miss it because you've oversimplified the content.
Right.
That's my concern.
Two things in the puzzle, for example, that both mention H.
Yes, there's that.
What if it was...
And people can adjust for that. You know, they use a different variable, but the problem is when the H represents more than just hat, and that's all they remember, or they remember two things, but there's actually three things in there, and then they miss it.
Let me point out another problem. If I were to pencil this out, I would have H arrow 7.
Yep.
Okay, and then the next rule is if I wear a coat, I have to leave at 8. So yeah. I would write C arrow 8.
Yep.
Look at those two things, H 7 C 8. Oh, they're not related.
Yep, that's another. It's a heuristic.
I could do the contrapositive of each of these things, right? So yep. If I write the contrapositive, so the first rule is if H then 7, contrapositive, if no 7, no H.
Yeah.
Second rule, if coat 8 a.m., so if C, then 8, mm-hmm. contrapositive, no 8, no C. Now I've got 4 logical statements diagrammed on my board.
Yeah.
And if I don't make the connection that if you leave at 7, you didn't leave at 8, and if you don't leave at 8, you didn't leave at 7, oh, sorry, if you do leave at 8, you didn't leave at 7, if I don't catch that 7 means no 8, and that 8 means no 7, If I don't catch that, and I don't think I would have with this example, if I had just gone for the pure diagramming approach,
it's a different part of your brain.
I don't think I make that connection. Yeah,
it's an analytical. Yeah, say more about that. Yeah, so this is coming from Thinking Fast and Slow or whatever by
Kahneman,
right? Like, there's that analytical part of your brain, and then there's the intuitive part of your brain, which is much bigger. And what we're inviting you to do is just understand this intuitively, read it, and get it. Like, oh, okay, if I put that hat on, I'm going to be heading out the door at 7. And if I put that coat on, then I'm heading out the door at 8. And you can almost, you can feel it, right? You're like, oh, can I leave at 7? Can I walk out the door at 7? Can I walk out the door at 8? No, I can't do that. So it's like your intuitive mind gets it. By the way, your intuitive mind is way bigger than your analytical mind. It's like 80 to 20 or something like that. But when you go analytical, you're shifting to a different part of your brain, and it's almost like dumb, right? It becomes blind to these things. It's like your intuitive mind has to come in and knock on the door and say, "By the way, if it's not 7, that's the same as, or if it's 8, that's the same as not 7," and you might not put that together. Anyways, I don't know if that makes sense, but.
Oh, I think the diagram actually hurts. I think that I want to apologize for my years of using a whiteboard when I was teaching LSAT logical reasoning, because I think it's one of the worst things that like traditional legacy prep foisted on generation after generation of LSAT student is this idea that you really need to be diagramming in order to understand this shit.
Yeah.
And it took a long time. It took me and Ben, it took 10 years for us to each come to this conclusion that it's actually much better to just do this in a more common sense way. That might be the worst thing that LSAT teachers ever did. Close second, or maybe tied for the worst thing, is this idea that you should read the question first on logical reasoning, because that just obviously does not help. And we blow people's minds when they come and start doing it our way. No note-taking, no highlighting, diagramming, underlining, no reading the question first. Just read the facts and make sense of these facts.
Yeah.
And once you do that, then you can answer any question.
For anyone who's still skeptical about that or just hearing that for the first time, it actually touches on, I think, fundamentally what we were just talking about. Because by getting rid of this stuff, reading the question first, highlighting, note-taking, all that sort of behavior, what we're doing is we're trying to free up your mind so that you can tap into the most powerful part, the intuitive part. Let it understand what's being said, and then it will run with that material. But if you get in the way of yourself and prevent that information from getting into your intuitive understanding, then you can't assess the information as well as you could if you did.
Kahneman called it System 1 and System 2. System 1 thinking is a near instantaneous process. It happens automatically, intuitively, and with little effort. It's driven by instinct and by our experiences. And it's instantaneous. It's fast. It's free points.
And it only works, though, when the idea lands, right? Like when you read it and you're like, oh, okay, I get it. I'm putting
instead of being distracted by... This is a must be true question, and I need to diagram these logical statements.
Yep.
That's system two. It's slower. Yeah. It requires more effort. It is conscious, which is good, I guess. It is logical, which is good, but it interferes with system one. And so people who try to deploy these real technical approaches, yeah, what they find is it just slows them down. And often it's going to end up, you know, it's going to introduce, because of the technicalities, it's going to introduce errors and it's going to interfere brutally with system one, especially the reading the question first on LR just kills your system one response to the argument. Because you're totally thinking like, no, no, I'm looking for a necessary assumption, or no, no, this is a flaw question. I have to do a certain operation on this. And it's like, well, wait, before you decide what operation you're doing, why don't you just think about the argument?
Think about what it's saying.
The answer might just spring to your mind before they even ask you the question.
And by the way, it might spring to your mind incorrectly, right? System one can be flawed based on your past experiences and so forth, but that's exactly why we do drilling. So you do a question, you fully engage with it intuitively with system one, you make a mistake, and then when you're reviewing it, you use system two to correct system one. Say, hey, like that wasn't quite the right way of thinking about it. And then you do it again, and you do it again, and you make this system one automatic and robust and fast. And that's why people can see massive score increases, because they're shifting the test to a totally different arena, right? You're not playing on the diagram. You're playing in the strong part of your brain.
Yeah, and it goes back to what Henry was saying in his pearls versus turds, right? The reason why that's a pearl, the reason why that idea to go, whoa, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling this need to triple check wrong answer choices. Wait a second, but I never miss questions in these first 10. Yeah, rely on system one. That's a pearl to just, you know, you're not going to miss these questions. Stop overthinking it. Stop overanalyzing it. Just kind of let it flow. Read the argument. You see what's there. You see what's good about it. You see what's bad about it. They ask you a question. You know the answer. You pick it. You move on to the next one. Deploy that system two for the harder ones, you know, a couple questions per section, instead of starting off with number one and number two and trying to treat it in this real formal, heavy-handed type of a way.
Excellent.
Should we wrap it up there?
We should. I want to thank Nick Hafen again for coming on to the podcast. He actually reached out to us. He's from BYU Law School. Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. Or on our socials at LSAT Demon. If you have questions about the LSAT Demon, you can email help@lsatdemon.com. Check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 452 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.